From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Jeff Maciolik announcing show number 29, recorded Tuesday, August 15th, 2006. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Codesmith Tools, makers of Codesmith, an extensible template-based code generator for .NET. Hansel Minutes listeners get $100 off Codesmith Professional with coupon code HM100 online at codesmithtools.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine, online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, the topic is dynamic versus compiled languages.
Hi, this is Carl Franklin, and you're listening to Hansel Minutes from HanselMinutes.com. I'm here with Scott Hanselman, as I am every week. Hi, Scott.
How are you, sir?
Good to talk to you again. And today we're doing a show on disruptive technologies. What do you mean by that exactly?
Well, I think that disruptive technologies that are the ones that come along every few years and remind us that maybe we're doing things a little more hard than we need to be.
Okay.
Spending a little bit more time on things that aren't as important. I think that that Ruby is a good example, and particularly Ruby on Rails is a good example of something that's come along and reminded us that, you know, development on the web really doesn't need to be this complicated. And we spent a lot of time as .NET developers suffering in the early ASP.NET years. And, you know, things are coming along that are disrupting kind of the way we think. You know, people are moving away from complex web applications to simpler patterns. And I think that Ruby and Ruby on Rails and the success of those technologies are worth exploring, but not just because it's something interesting that's not Microsoft, but because most of the people I think that listen to this show are Microsofties in some way. Microsoft and .NET pay our mortgages, but that what can we as .NET developers learn from Ruby and Ruby on Rails to apply to our lives as .NET developers?
Okay.
Right? This doesn't mean we should necessarily jump ship, but, you know, you're writing code. Like, just for example, the code that you use to manage Hansel Minutes and the shows that you work on.
Right.
It's all written in ASP.NET, right? You've got an administrative console.
Yeah.
It's mostly using what we call CRUD, right? Create, read, update, delete.
Sure.
There's a lot of code there. I mean, how much code are we talking about for the Hansel Minutes admin?
No, not a lot of code.
Couple of thousand lines, couple hundred lines. What do you think?
A couple hundred lines. Really not a lot of code at all.
So you use a lot of data grids, data binding, things like
exactly.
that? Exactly. Did you write a lot of stored procedures?
Just a few. Yeah.
Did you do any code generation?
No.
So there's an example kind of a middle of the road .NET application, does some creates, reads, updates, and deletes. You probably mm-hmm. used a lot of the wizards. You took advantage of as much as .NET as possible. And, you know, being that you are a trainer on this kind of stuff, you're not going to waste your time writing code that really already exists.
Exactly.
Right?
And for us, you know, the only people who have to use it are inside, you know, in-house, maybe three or four people, and usually only one at a time.
Sure. So it doesn't need to necessarily be pretty, but it's very functional. I mean, I've used it and I've done administration on the show, so it's not that big of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a good example of what we would call kind of the 80% example. It's the adding of information to a system, retrieving it, looking at it, sorting it, adding details. If you were going to do something like an upgrade to it, you'd probably kind of do it manually. You'd change the schema and then you'd change the code and it would work just fine.
Right.
Now, in the .NET world, when you go file new web application, you pretty much get a blank page. You know, hello world is really the start when you go file new ASP.NET application. In the Ruby on Rails world, there's you get a little bit more. Rails assumes that you're probably going to be talking to a database, and it has a thing called scaffolding. You basically say, I want to scaffold out an application. And when you run scaffolding after installing Ruby and Rails and maybe something like MySQL, you sit down and you basically go and say Rails space, and then if I wanted an application called foo, I'd say Rails space foo. And mm-hmm. I would get a whole application created for me, an empty web application that would run under really any web server, but, you know, typically you can run it under either their built-in web server or under something like Apache. And Okay. You get started up. You're basically, you get a Hello World page that says, congratulations, you're on Rails.
It reminds me of a Visual Basic application wizard or something like that.
Right. It gives you a lot more, I think, than we're really used to getting. I think that...
But is it good? Is it good code? Is it something... Is it typical wizard output, or is it something that actually is sustainable?
Well, so here's the thing that's so interesting about Rails is that they have a philosophy which they call convention over configuration. We talked about this a little bit in a previous show as a philosophy that we like to apply to .NET code. Mm-hmm. But they have a lot of conventions. You know, they say that... You know, stuff goes in the config folder, and we have a folder called test, and we have a folder called app. And you can't change those, right? That's what the folder's name is.
Right.
Right. And this is a generalization, but in a .NET application, you typically have some app, you know, config file where you could override that the name of that directory is this, or I want this file to be over there. They say, no, we're going to really focus on convention.
Standardize that stuff.
Exactly. One less thing to worry about. Now, the code that gets generated, what's interesting about it is there's so nothing there. It's incredibly simple. And what really makes Rails work is that it understands how the software development process should work. For example, when you're dealing with a database, you typically have the development database, maybe a test one for running your unit tests, and a production one. With .NET, there's really no built-in way that knows that this is the case. Right. You typically will have different connection strings, right? You have a connection string that you would modify in a web.config. In Rails, they have a thing called a database.yml file. It's basically like an .ini file. And within that, you indicate different environments. You can say, well, I'm going to use the MySQL adapter during development and talk to this database on the local host with this name and password. But when I go to test, I'll run over here. And when I go to production, I'll be using this different adapter. So it actually knows that there are different modes. It's built that in. So there's just an example where the way that development is done in software is built into the application itself. The whole framework knows that this is how things happen.
Well, there's plenty of that stuff in ASP.NET, I would argue.
Where in ASP.NET, other than saying debug equals false, do you indicate that now I am developing, now I am testing, now I am in production?
No, that's not what I meant. That's not what I meant. I meant, you know, the kind of nice extra things, such as the ability to just drag a table from data and have an editable grid. You know, that's a nice high-level feature. The connection strings in the config file, is a standardized way. The personalization... I mean, there's a lot of high-level features in ASP.NET, especially 2.0, that you could consider falling into that same camp of extra stuff.
Okay, let me rephrase then. That's a good point. But so there are lots of things in ASP.NET that make development easy, but I think that there's not necessarily a whole lot of things that make the development process easy. Migrations, for example, when you migrate from one version of an app to another version of an app, right? Let's say I build an application, I make a table with people, and I've got a first name column and a last name column. And I've got an object that I'm going to be storing in that column. Within ASP.NET, I might create a class person, and he has a first name and a last name. And then I might take that user, and maybe I'll use something like nhibernate, but not a lot of average Joe developers use tools like that. They're object relational mappers. So typically, they'll write the data access layer themselves, right? And they'll take that object apart and make sure that object gets put into the table appropriately. So then the application changes. I have to modify the schema, right? So I'll go into SQL, modify the schema, and then generate a SQL file that I have to remember to run on the production database to alter that table and add a new column. And then I have to go into my code and then tell it that there's this new middle name field that's going to be added to our person table. And then update my data access code to put that middle name in there. So it's not hard. It's just detail oriented. There's a lot of stuff there. Within Rails, there's this notion of migrations where you make a change and it keeps track of what is going to be required to get you from this state, like version 1, to this state, version 1.1.
Okay.
So all of this is being handled by a thing called Active Record. An Active Record would let you do things like class project, and then you could say something like derives from Active Record, and a project belongs to... a portfolio and a project has one project manager. A project has many milestones. It sounds like I'm just reading English. That's kind of what Ruby looks like when you're using Active Record. You might have in the database the description of what a project looks like, and you just write your class like that. I mean, the class project might be 5 lines, just exactly as I described it. You would literally write down class project has one project manager. And those relationships then get managed by this Active Record system, and it handles the persistence of that to and from the database. Because Ruby is such a dynamic language, it handles it. So then if I wanted to migrate from one version of my application to another, I can automatically just generate the migration by describing what's changed, by making a change and saying, all right, I'm going to go from this version to that version, and it'll handle it for you. It also keeps track of irreversible migrations when I move forward, but I can't back up. Because one of the other things that Rails allows you to do is say, I want to roll back. I just made a goof. I added something to my database. I've changed my application, but it was a bad idea. I need to push the easy button and roll back everything automatically.
So, Scott, the next question that comes to my mind is, are these features that Microsoft, if they were listening, could say, hey, that's a good feature. We'll add that to the next ASP.NET. Or is it more indicative of the dynamic language nature of Ruby that these features become possible?
And
which
I think you've absolutely nailed it right there. You've asked both the right questions. One, is Microsoft going to move towards this? And definitely, I think that this is a computer science thing that's happening, not necessarily a Microsoft thing. Everyone's headed in this direction where we've had this schizophrenia, right? You know, 30 years ago, you have your small talk folks that have got this very dynamic world, and then C++ and C start getting more static typing. C++ starts making decisions about how inheritance works. C# says, all right, we don't allow multiple inheritance. Things get stronger and stronger typed. So in the Windows world, we're kind of having the screws tightened on us. So over the last kind of 15, 20 years, the screws have been tightened and the developers are dealing with it, right? To mix my metaphors, right? You know how to boil a frog, right?
Yeah, you boil them in cold water and turn up the heat slowly, right?
So why do you think that people are so excited about JavaScript and Ajax and about PowerShell? Because suddenly this, all the power of .NET and all the freedom of a dynamic language is kind of coming out. So I think that, yes, part of it is that Ruby is such a dynamic language. But I think that if you take a look at C# 3.0, like at Shrinkster/HEI, you're going to see that Anders and the folks that are designing C# 3.0 are adding this dynamicism.
Dynamism.
That too. They're adding that to C# 3.0, and they're making that happen. And it's technologies like Link, L-I-N-Q, at Shrinkster/H-E-H, that are making that possible, right? Where you can have all of the benefits of a compiler, but also some of that dynamic behavior that you see in an interpreted language. And this is a really interesting question. What is limiting this technology in the Microsoft world right now? And I think it's the fact that we're strongly typed language, that underneath VB and underneath C#, there's that IL, right?
Right.
There's that compiler. What do we lean on? What do we count on? Well, C++ programmers, they really count on the compiler. You know, I don't have a lot of bugs, or I know that nothing horrible is going to happen because the really, really strict compiler told me it was cool.
Right.
Right? They know that something horrible is wrong before they run because the compiler catches it. But VB, like VB6 people, there were some dynamic language aspects to VB6 with variants that you really didn't know the behavior until you actually run it. So they moved that responsibility out of the compiler a bit. But where did that go? Where did the responsibility go? They took 20% of the responsibility out of the compiler. There weren't a lot of unit tests. I didn't run a lot of unit tests in VB6. Did you?
No, there wasn't even such a thing, really.
Exactly. So then about 20% of the quote-unquote responsibility, this theoretical responsibility there of, you know, who's going to check stuff, kind of fell on the floor. That got picked up. We moved into the .NET world where we had really strong compilers, but also some dynamic aspects of things with reflection with late binding that allowed us to do things that could get us in trouble. But we picked that ball up with test-driven development. So now we lean on the compiler halfway and on the tests halfway.
So you're saying with test-driven development, or even just running NUnit for crying out loud, we are we can now, variants aren't evil anymore. Is this what you're saying? Not, you know
that's a good way to put it. It's kind of an inflammatory way to put it, but you're right.
I'm trying to eke out, you know, the,
no,
the,
you're right. Because what I'm saying is that dynamic languages are less evil if you have a parachute, right?
Okay.
So our parachute in C++ was a really hardcore compiler that wouldn't let us get away with anything.
Yep.
And we had less of a parachute in VB6, and this is why you get object reference not set all the time with old VB applications, right? This is the, because what does that really mean, right? What does an exception mean? If you get an unhandled exception in your application, it means something happened that you weren't ready for. Something exceptional happened, something you didn't expect occurred. Now, in a dynamic language, I can write a Ruby application, I can hit save, and no one's going to do anything. No one cares that I have syntax errors all through it. So it's on me to then fill it up with better testing. So what I'm saying is that really awesome tests within an interpreted dynamic environment can actually take the place of the compiler. They are taking the place of the compiler because all that the compiler does is it syntax checks your intent.
Right.
But a test is a really great way of expressing your intent.
And it goes beyond the compiling stage. It actually looks for results.
Exactly. So then someone could really get some real good work done if they had a language that had a really great compiler, but also a flexible enough syntax that would let them do the kinds of things like active record that one would want to do in a performant way. And then they could build tests around it and they have the best of both worlds. And I think that 5 years from now, we're going to see a very Ruby-esque C-sharp and a very Ruby-esque VB as people start to realize that Smalltalk has had these kinds of features for 30 years and we've been off kind of in the desert, in our strongly typed hardcore compiler languages, we're going to find a very dynamic middle ground that's going to involve very few lines of code. So what are some examples of active record and or Rails in the Microsoft world?
Well, before you answer that question, let me ask this, which may be on the listener's mind also. What if you're not embracing test-driven development?
Wow. Be afraid. Let me put it this way.
Because not everybody does.
Well, and you know, and everybody should. This is the thing. That'll mean more work for you.
Well,
and more work
not for me,
us.
But yeah.
Not for you, but you know, I'm saying that let me give you an example. I had an intern this summer. I wanted to actually get him on the show, but it didn't work out. But I had an intern and he just finished up yesterday. We gave our presentation to everybody and he worked on an ASP.NET application. That did some online banking stuff for some things that I'm working on I can't talk about. This is a 16-year-old sophomore in high school, okay? Guy's never coded C-sharp before. He did a little bit of Java in high school. He did a little VB6, and he played with Ruby once or twice. And in 30 working days, put together a nice, clean online banking site where someone could log in and pay their bills. Now, how did he accomplish this? We used test-driven development. We used Water, right? The web application testing in Ruby for all of our tests. And we used test-driven development. He wrote 168 tests in Water that would just beat on this thing, most of it with negative testing. Because this is a guy who has no computer science background. He's a 16-year-old kid. And he just thought about, well, what would someone evil do to try to break my application? So he had hundreds of tests that would just put in garbage in text boxes and try to transfer too much money and just fight with this application. He pounded on it like only a 16-year-old could. And we ended up with more code in our tests than we did in our application because the goal was for the application to do exactly what it needed to do and no more and allow only the correct input. And when he coded in this style, he ended up with a lot of work in the tests, but then that test became his parachute. We had to go and do some refactoring after we gave the presentation. He had a few hours before the end of his summer, and we had a bunch of requirements. They said, we need these things changed. He's like, oh man, I don't want to change this application. It's going to break everything. And I said, no, it's not. You've got 168 tests that'll prove. If anything is broken, you'll know immediately. And we were right. And that sense of confidence of, wow, I can refactor this. We cut another 100 lines out of the application, and the 168 tests passing were our confidence that this thing works. not just that it compiles, because compiling just says the syntax is right, but the intent, the semantics were correct.
Well, Scott, that's a very good argument why people should use and embrace test-driven development. However, there are those people that won't, simply because it's not a requirement. It's not.
Yeah,
it's
I
not
understand
required.
What you're saying.
And
they will have buggy code. And I
well,
God
will,
have mercy
will,
on their
the
souls.
Question is, will it be buggier with a dynamic C sharp and a dynamic VB?
That's a very good point.
Then
so here's an example. Let me say this. Let's say I wrote some test scripts, okay? And I wrote them to work on an application. And let's say that you're going to write it in an application that has only object, totally dynamic, right? No strongly typing.
Right.
And then I'll write it in C sharp. And our tests will run against both applications.
Yes.
Right? So the exact same tests will do the exact same stuff to a browser. And the app just happens to be written in two different, totally different languages. As long as all 100 and some odd tests pass, does it really matter what language it was written in?
Okay, now take away the tests.
There you go. If the tests weren't there, we can't know.
Right. So the question is, if you have a dynamic language that's set up to allow this kind of variant, behavior.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a good point.
Does it make it a liability not to use test-driven development?
I think it does. That's a good point. So doing development in a dynamic language without a lot of tests could potentially open you up to a lot of weird data typing conversion type of errors. That's why I think that negative testing is so important.
So then that brings us to the other conclusion, which is if you do not, if there are more people not doing test-driven development than doing test-driven development, are they not going to move to the new dynamic languages and they're going to stay with the old version of .NET?
That was too many knots there. I got confused somewhere
In other words, let's say 65% of the development going on does not use test driven development, it's even more than that.
Oh, I'm sure it's lots.
Right. So C Sharp 3.0 comes out, VBNet 17, whatever it is, comes out, and they're both dynamic languages. Is that going to keep people from upgrading to the new version, possibly of a new framework? Of a new language.
That's a good question. I think that the beat marches on, right? Things continue to move forward. The issue is that when you go to a Microsoft presentation every 3 or 4 years, they sit down with the Northwind database, they drag a data grid over, and they say, "And look what I did without writing a single line of code," right? They've been doing this for 15 years.
Sure.
Right. Every few years we go and we see the big data grid presentation.
Right.
Except this year we drug the data grid over and it did Ajax. Okay. With things like Blink, BLINQ, it shrinks to /HEG, which is the closest thing to Rails on ASP.NET that Microsoft has come out with.
Okay.
Lets you basically dynamically generate an entire ASP.NET website for displaying, creating data, doing all CRUD type data based on a database schema without writing any code at all. So there's not even any dragging around. I mean, they don't even go into, you don't even go into Visual Studio. You just say, do it, and it happens.
Wow.
So I think when people see that, we could go and rewrite the Hansel Minutes admin with a tool like this Blink prototype by Polita Paulus. And once people see that, if they don't move forward, then maybe that's not what they wanted, right? I mean, Microsoft's trying to make products to make life easier. If Microsoft doesn't do it, somebody else will, and people will say,
man.
"Ooh,
I want that." I don't know if that's a strong enough argument for me, but we'll see. Basically, what it means is that people are being forced into test-driven development, and will they go? So it'll be interesting to see.
Well, let me ask you this then. Here's a better argument. Were people forced into using source control when Microsoft started giving away Visual Source Safe? Right. Before, people in the Windows world weren't using source control. Everyone was using source control in the Unix world. But Microsoft people would just zip up their files and say, well, there you go. That's version for today. Zip it up and put it over on a share. You know, people are going to use test-driven development because A, it's free, and B, it works.
So you think there'll be a competitive advantage to being test-driven?
Oh, yeah. You know, let me give you an example. There's a shareware developer who had some applications that I installed because, you know, if it exists, I've run it and installed it on my machine at least once. And I had some trouble with it, so I emailed him. And you know what he said? It's amazing. He says, go to the help about. I'm like, okay, help about. And he says, you see a button there that says run tests? He actually ships his NUnit tests, and in the help about menu hid an NUnit runner. So he actually shipped him, and I ran his entire test suite on my machine, which let him see if the environment that I was running on would pass his test. And one of the tests didn't pass because he made an assumption about a path.
Neat.
What a brilliant way to do production time developing, production time debugging, rather.
There's no doubt about it that when you reach the end of a life cycle of an application built with test-driven development, you've got a superior product. I guess the people on the other side of the camp, and I'm not taking a position either way, I'm saying the people on the other side of the camp say, well, you know, if you live in an ivory tower world where, you know, there's an infinite amount of time and money to develop, great. But, you know, for the rest of the real world people out here, we're trying to build apps as fast as we can, as most stable as we possibly can.
All right, well, let me give you one more argument, and then we'll do a couple links and we'll move on.
Okay.
So if you can express the requirement, the business requirement, in a simple test, right, the requirement is they must be able to read a record, change it, and save it, and, you know, these conditions will be met. You can say that in English, or any language for that matter. You can say it in prose and write it in a Word document. But as I've said before, a Word document doesn't have any teeth, right? Word documents don't break builds. Exceptions stop applications, but Word documents don't actually do anything. But if I can write a test in a very simple, straightforward way that says, this is my intent, right? We've spent so much time writing code to express our intent, but we're expressing that intent to the computer, right? Well, the computer is not the customer here. The customer is whoever has hired me to write this application.
Sure.
So my tests are the best description in computer language of what that person's intent are. So if you look at test-driven development as a way of translating that person's intent into something the computer understands, and then also proving that the requirement is met, you can look at all of those green bars that light up in NUnit telling you that your application works well as basically saying, my requirement was met for this application. And if you look at it that way, you'll spend less time writing specs because specs aren't useful, right? Specs can't test my application, but tests can.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be a better argument.
Okay.
One other thing I wanted to mention was that we were talking about what it was like to have Rails and or Active Record on Windows.
Right.
There's something worth checking out called the Castle Project. You can take a look at shrinkster.com/HEN. And Castle is a set of tools that you can work with them together, or you can use them independently, that let you integrate better your applications. And the really interesting ones are Monorail. Monorail is basically, they used to call it Castle on Rails, but it's basically Rails for ASP.NET. It's a different style. It's more of a model view controller, what they call MVC or Action Pack way of doing things. There's an interesting explanation about how it works, why you might want to do it, why it would be useful. If you like Rails, you might check that out. But the most interesting thing, I think, is a layer that sits on top of nHibernate, right? nHibernate is the object relational mapper that lets you take objects and map them with XML relationship files into the database.
Mm-hmm.
This is a version of Active Record and the Active Record pattern for .NET. It's built on top of nHibernate, but it frees you of all of that XML tediousness.
All right, so a couple more. We got time for a couple more links.
Sure. Yeah, if you want to check out Blink, which is BLINQ, Blink, there's a really good tutorial at ARS Technica at shrinkster/HEJ, and then FTP Online has a great tutorial from last month on how to use Blink at shrinkster/HEK. And again, you can download Blink at shrinkster/HEG. And then do check out the Castle Project. It's a really interesting way to think about things. It's different from ASP.NET. It's not how you're used to doing web applications, and that might be a good thing. shrinkster/HEN.
Excellent. Well, Scott, it sounds like you got to go there. I hear Zenzo crying in the background, so we'll let you go.
I think I've got a poopy baby on my hands. I got a jet.
And we'll see you next week on Hansel Minutes.